Welcome to Dragon King Talk. I'm Jarl Thor, and this is a community talk on the Dark Sun Discord. Check out the Discord event and join us. Okay, welcome to Dragon King Talk. I'm Jarl Thor, and this is Skeletor, and we're hosting DK Talk today with the topic being halflings. We're joined here by Silsane and Dragoth and a few others in the chat. Guys, welcome to Dragon King Talk.
Yep, thanks for having us.
Well, I guess we're going to start on the OSB. What's kind of written in there. It was kind of odd because I didn't see really halflings, you know, their natural kind of eating habits mentioned in the halfling entry. I had to go down farther into some of the society and the nomadic lifestyle to get more of their society, at least as it is in the feral halfling society.
Well, there's certainly a lot more to them than just their tendency to eat other people.
There's a lot to them in this OSB, and a lot of it I had never even known.
Yeah, just like the first and foremost that comes to mind when you think of Dark Sun Halfling is that they, you know, they eat other people, or, you know, quotations, they're cannibals. But yeah, there's a lot more depth to them than that.
Well, and that being said, they say in this entries that they almost will never attack another halfling, even, you know, they will do what they can to, you know, subdue that halfling while they, you know, attack his buddies, but they generally won't fight other halflings, so I can only imagine they wouldn't eat other halflings either.
You know, that leads back to the lifelong question of, are all these other races considered halflings? They all start. You know, they all came from halflings at some point, other than the Thargreen, so.
I don't think that's general knowledge to the tribal halflings anyways, so.
It's not really general knowledge to anybody.
Precisely.
It is, however, believed by some that it is the remnants of some sort of cultural memory that they once were halflings, and that by eating them, they're bringing them back into the fold.
That's interesting. Okay.
Yeah, there's a little more depth to it.
That's something I've read a couple of times. I don't know how canon it is, but it's an interesting take on it.
Well, if you look in book one with Nock's comments on when they're about to eat Rikus and them, you can kind of see that played out when they're like, we're going to return you, to nature, you know, to the cycle of life. It kind of implies. So you can see there's a disconnect kind of maybe to what the halflings would see more in their original times than what these feral halflings see it as. They don't really see it as returning the halflings that mutated into what they are now to the halfling race. They see it in much more of a nature way, I think, in the way that Nock referenced it, you know.
It kind of can almost reminiscent like to, like, you know, you see in Avatar when they kill a creature and, you know, they kind of like say like a prayer to, what was it, Awa, that they're returning them back to whatever the, you know, to the greater world. I can kind of see something similar with that with the halflings.
Yeah, because when I hear Nock's comments on it, and then I kind of see what the references, I have seen the references Skeletor's mentioning, and I think that's probably where it originally came from, and then it's kind of moved over to legends and lore at this point, and that original thought of returning the mutated races to the halfling race is now been kind of replaced by just the, you know, the legend of returning them to nature, you know, for whatever reason. They don't really get into all that deep history of it because, again, you know, as Skeletor mentioned earlier, nobody really has this general knowledge, not even the halflings at this point.
I mean, another interesting concept might be, I mean, jumping ahead, like when they were Relisti, I mean, what did the Relisti eat? They probably produced their own food through life shaping, right? So,
ooh.
By extension, the rebirth, I mean, more like bending, but kind of similar. So maybe somewhere that got muddled. It seems like it's in the halfling's nature to forget things. It might be some stemmed from that as well.
Well, that's an interesting thought. Is there anything in the Wind Riders of the Jagged Cliffs about life-shaping tech that produces food or culture of how what they eat? You know, I wonder if any of that's in there.
I think it's very limited on what they actually talk about.
That's not at all unreasonable, though. Right, Evangian stating that the brown tide came about because of a mistake on an attempt to expand the productive ability of the ocean.
So they was getting their food from the ocean then?
The world was mostly an ocean, right? So the vast majority of their food supply would likely have come from the water.
Yeah, because anywhere that wasn't water was very much used for proper living space and building, you know, out from... It's basically what you can see as from, I can't remember the name of the city, but it's built over a giant lake, and they kind of just build over the water. And I think that's a lot of how it was, is any place where there was land, they kind of built out from that, meaning that they didn't have land to grow crops and things along in those lines, because...
I'm sure they a lot of their diet consisted of, you know, whatever they could get from the ocean, be it that they did, you know, they made it through, you know, life shaping, or if it was natural, like obviously there were fish, there was probably crustaceans of some type, and maybe even eating some type of like kelp or, you know, seaweed type
algae.
Taste. Yeah, algae. So.
I mean, the brown tide itself most likely was some sort of mutated algae.
Yes.
That's what it seems like to me. Yeah. Or bacteria, but I mean, even then, it'd be able to resemble algae if it's across an ocean.
Yeah. I've come across some interesting theories about the brown tide where it's not algae at all. I don't necessarily subscribe to it, but that basically the brown tide represented like earth flooding into the water.
Huh.
Again, I don't necessarily subscribe to that. Yeah, like mud, basically somehow like a portal to the elemental plane of Earth or whatever filled into the ocean.
That's interesting.
That is a completely different take on it, that's for sure.
I mean this is from years ago. Again, I don't necessarily think I buy into that, but just thought it was worth sharing.
Was that some talk on the old Dark Sun Arena boards?
Yeah, way back. I mean, that's something that was brought up at least 20-something years ago.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, I mean, not an original theory by me, by any means, but I can't remember the source of it.
That's one of the reasons those boards were missed, because there was a lot of discussions on there you can't go back and search up, you know.
Believe me, I tried to. I tried to go back in the way back, you know, machine type sites, and it's tough to dig that stuff up. It's a shame that WotC just got rid of all that stuff.
Yeah, that's an interesting point Evangian brings up. And he does confirm it is canon. They had floating and underwater cities as well as extensive tunnels under the ocean, probably very similar to what we see in the city by the Sealed Sea Book. But yeah, Evangian talking about the advanced biotech civilization, you know, he makes a good point. The population of the Blue Age halflings was probably far in excess of what you would think such a small amount of land could support. And that would bring about the need for the brown tide.
or the need for whatever the brown tide was meant to actually be.
Yeah. It definitely didn't become that.
Oh, absolutely. No, the halflings have a history of just grew up.
Well, so. I mean, you've got to think about where life shaping comes from to begin with. And it basically came from them finding a rock somewhere in the ocean and that was able to change its shape into whatever they wanted.
I'm reading it right now. Under the sea, they found a living pore stone that they could manipulate to grow into any desired shape. From this basic substance, they learned the process of manipulating the building blocks of living things. One could also say that maybe they mean DNA by that.
I believe it was unofficially called through one of Athos.org's products called PITH, P-I-T-H. But someone can correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, Vangian might know if Athos.org has a name for that life-shaping stone.
Yeah, I think it comes out of there, that the life-shaping handbook they produced years ago.
Named it.
Yeah, naming it PITH, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, go ahead, Drago.
I was going to say that it kind of throws it off because there's lots of things that will use, like, use the word PITH, even going back to referencing some of the video games and stuff, there was a PITH extract in one of them, I believe. So
yeah, in Shattered Lands.
So that it is mentioned otherwise than being the name of the story.
Okay. All right. Good to know. I did not know that. I never played the video. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a quest thing. You're sent to take some PITH to somebody else and they sort of refine it and you take it to another healer for them to use it to do something with the settlement.
And what's it mentioned there at?
Well, I know that the final product is it's just called PITH extract, but I don't remember what the one that you take to be refined is called offhand.
It was just the name of PITH that kind of went out there and brought that to my brain.
I just found a very interesting picture in the Jagged Cliffs, and I'm posting it in the Dragon King chat. But it looks to me like a sea creature that is possibly life-shaped being ridden by two life-shaping Rusty. That look like they have biotech, like somebody else would have cybernetics.
Yeah.
It's Rankiki PITH or Raniki PITH.
Oh, the name of the stone?
No, that's from the video game. You are given, you are requested by an NPC in Tequetzal to bring him some Rankiki PITH, which you can get from the Elven Trader in the Red Sands area. You bring it to him and he refines it, tells you to take it to the healer in another one of the slave villages.
That has any.
But Raniki or Rankiki, it says Rankiki here in this walkthrough that I'm looking at, but I feel like that's a typo. That's a plant that's like got like anti-insect kind of properties. I know that there's a spell that can emulate the smoke from it, and it works as like a anti-vermin barrier.
Oh wow, very cool. But not the floating stone of legend, though.
I don't think it's associated with that, no.
I'm going to try to bring up the life-shaping handbook from Athos.org.
Yeah, I've got this picture up, though, and it shows the sea beast. Now it looks like one of the halflings is at a control panel that's a bioorganic control panel of this sea creature floating through the water. At least I assume it's water. I don't think it's silt.
Definitely water.
Yeah, that's definitely water.
Definitely a very unique picture. I mean, kind of cool, very futuristic.
But it's very, very ancient past for Athys.
Yep.
But this is the kind of stuff that they were doing.
Yeah, I feel like, I almost feel like what was mentioned by Troy Denning in the fifth book when Andronopoulos, however you butcher his name.
Dropping it, but yep.
He does his little flashback projection for the whole crowd, you know, and when he when you see the halflings there, to me they seem a little less biotech and a little less of what it's presented as in the Wind Riders of the Jagged Cliffs.
I know there's definitely, like, I read something regarding like a cloning machine of some sort that Orcus had. I believe that it sounds very biotech.
Yeah, from Dead God's adventure. So something that could produce a living body, and that's what Orcus was hoping, or at the time Tenebris was hoping to bring himself back to life using, but ultimately didn't work for his purposes.
Yeah, yeah. It's described very squeaky kind of biotech.
Yep.
Yeah, and I don't really think that that was necessarily the original vision, but that's definitely where we're at now. And just looking at this picture, you could see that the biotech is like cybernetics for them, but it's more than that. The creature that guy's holding in his hand reminds me of somebody holding a messenger pigeon, you know? And so, you know, seeing their mastery over other life forms, you know, it really brings in the focus of what was written about in this book, you know, on life shape.
Yeah, it's like I've always thought that life shaping had some amazing possibilities. I just didn't know, like, exactly on what scale it was. Because this is the first time I've seen this picture, and it's very advanced.
Well, what's funny is that Troy Denning, he wrote a Star Wars novel, specifically for the Yuuzhan Vong, right?
Is he the one who started that, or he just wrote on it? Because a lot of people wrote on that.
Yeah, I can't remember if he originated the idea or just carried it forward, but they used a lot of biotech themselves. And the rumor is it's like, he had this intended for future, you know, novels, the Dark Sun novels, but he ended up obviously porting it over to Star Wars. Nothing substantiated on that, but interesting nonetheless.
Well, I'm definitely going to Google that now, so thank you for that.
And I'm going to use on
Bong from Star Wars, very squeaky biotech type stuff, too.
Yep. And I'm going to show my age right now. Back in the old G.I. Joe cartoons, the G.I. Joe movie, they introduced this...
Cobra Law?
The Cobra Law, and they use biotech. And I swear Troy Denning kind of, or whoever, got their inspiration for the Rollisti, looking at that.
Yeah, like they even had something like a timer that was basically just a stick with a worm crawling up it.
They used a lot of spore type stuff. It was all organic type weaponry. Even their armor was like kind of like crab shell. I mean, I'm sure it hasn't aged well, but if you could probably catch it on YouTube somewhere, bits and pieces of it.
Yeah, it's... let's get back to the
original non-realistic. Yeah.
The original halfling tribes from Athasian society.
Oh yeah. And
that's where they go ahead.
If you look in this book, you know, it goes into their like the halfling tribes. It even talks about raiding groups that may descend to take prisoners or items back to their village as a gift for the chief. So they are known to come down from the forest, you know, climb over the forest ridge just to go after people. You know, it says here, sneak up on a sleeping caravan, a village, sometimes even a city, carry away whatever they can lay their hands on, goods, animals, and peoples, the animals, and sometimes the people they eat immediately. But they usually attempt to take prisoners and items back to their village as a gift for the chief.
All right, so they're not just going there to kill, you know, the average human or anything like that. But they will, you know, they'll take some as prisoners, but any that they kill, they eat immediately.
Well, and they will take some back for the chief. I think that's... I think it's people they usually try to take, not animals.
I mean, anything that is still living, they might bring back just, you know, to provide food.
Yeah, it's all food for them, in my opinion. You see several entries here for them, though, throughout this part of the OSP.
That's now kind of backed up in the first book of the Prison Pen Tag when the you know, the heroes of Tur go to the forest ridge. That they kind of like I forget the name of the mute halfling gladiator brought them to the forest ridge unbeknownst by them to be basically a tribute or food for her tribe.
Yeah, definitely. It that's definitely what happened in the first book. And then if you carry that over to the third book, Nock and a raiding tribe, part of the raiding party of that tribe, actually come looking for Sidira.
Yep.
Which it even mentions that in the OSP that sometimes they will leave, you know, as a raiding party to go, you know, take care of somebody who has done wrong to the tribe.
Oh, yeah. And they'll leave for many reasons beyond that. Even further down, it's page 36. It goes deeper into the how they have an ethic to never harm each other or try to offend each other, but they consider anything else fair game for the stew pot. Captured humans and demi-humans are considered a delicacy and are usually taken to the chief as an offering, but some clans eat their quarry on the spot, particularly if hunting has not been good of late.
Yeah, it definitely seems like they would not attack other halflings or eat them. To me, it definitely seems like that, and that's what it implied.
And it kind of goes into the fact that they will come down from the forest ridge to do raids and everything else on, you know, either human or other demi-human settlements or anything.
Now, they do get an XP bonus in this book from learning other people's cultures and their customs.
Even though it says they have extreme problems doing things like this.
But if they achieve it, they get the XP, racial XP bump.
Probably under the right circumstances, because, I mean, like, again, maybe jumping ahead, but, you know, the halflings that work for Hominu and Uruk, they must have, like, adopted some type of Urukite, you know, etiquette to be able to exist in that society, right?
Do they work for Ulrich too, or is it just Nimne that some of those halflings were working for?
Well, no, it was for, did I say Nimne? I meant to say Hominu, but Hominu, yeah, for Hominu. Because in the Crimson Legion book, there was halflings out there trying to get Rikus, I believe, when he was a separated from his legion.
Yep, I had forgotten about that.
Yeah, Hominu struck a deal with, I forget if they named the chieftain or not, but of the of a halfling chieftain of a specific tribe in the Forest Ridge, which, you know, he gave them I don't know how many halflings, but seems like it was a lot, basically, of a congeniant of halflings that serve Hominu.
Yeah, I remember reading about that. I'm going to have to ask June Solar about that when I do his interview on Ulrich. But they definitely... Now, was they on retainer for with Hominu, or was they on retainer with Matan's house, the house that was leading that attack?
That's a good point. I believe it was with Hominu directly, but someone have to fact check me on that.
Well, going further down to answer your question about Yurik, they talk about Ogo, which is the home of the halfling chief Urga Zoltapil. Or what, I don't know how you pronounce that.
That's good enough.
Yeah. It consists of a massive step pyramid rising just high enough so that its summit sits beneath the shade of the forest canopy, so about 75 feet. The palace sits atop this pyramid, and it's here that he receives his tribesmen, dozen stone buildings, and then Ogo is unique among halfling villages in that an outsider may hope to visit it without being eaten, but I would suggest undertaking the journey only in the company of halflings from Yurik.
Yeah, Evangian confirms it's Hamanu. Well, that's really interesting, Dragoff, because I had no idea about him, but it sounds like he has a hell of a ziggurat, you know, at his disposal and the convenience of Hamonu. So that's a very interesting halfling village there to mention. I don't think it's mentioned anywhere else than the OSB either, is it? I don't know.
It's, you know, it's just a short little couple of paragraphs, you know, talking about a halfling village. And, you know, it's one that breaks the normal that if, you know, a person other than a halfling shows up there, that you will be, you know, there's a chance you'll be eaten on the spot.
It's mentioned in Dune Trader. The Dune Trader book might have more on that that group. But that is definitely cool they brought them into that, because that explains where they came from in book two.
You know, reading these little passages, just trying to find mention of halflings is kind of bringing a lot more out of what they, you know, what they tried to do to develop halflings in the OSB.
Yeah, because there's a lot of interesting stuff in the OSB that sometimes gets overlooked. And a lot of times people bring it up to me and I'm like, oh, well, I never knew that was in the OSB. I go look it up and there's a whole bunch of cool stuff there I've never read, you know, so...
Yeah, but the OSB has a lot of deeps. I mean, even outside of halflings, just, I think we talked about this the other day, just random location where they just kind of dropped a little bit of like a hook for the DM to, you know, either develop themselves, or maybe they had plans for it later and later supplements that unfortunately never came. But yeah, a lot of great stuff in the OSB.
Kind of like Gulstanel, Dragoff's home city, turned into all that, you know, from where in the OSB it was just a mention of the that sonic spirit that's there. You know, that's pretty much the only mention of it that's there. You know,
call the caller. Yep.
Yeah, halfling curiosity. I think it's mentioned here in the OSB, maybe. Their curiosity demands that they attempt to learn many of the customs of those they confront on the outside world. This is not to say that a halfling character will adopt these customs. On the contrary, they will almost certainly not. But a wide variety of experiences is encouraged by the clerical teachings of halfling witch doctors. They see the customs of others as no threat to their own, and as a welcome chance to learn through a different point of view. That's a very interesting passage there.
Agreed. I think halflings, they get generalized as always as being savages that are going to just instantly attack you.
Well, that's because, you know, like it states, there's more of a chance if you're not a halfling and you show up at a halfling village, you will be looked at as dinner.
Yeah. Well, showing up to a village unannounced, yes, but...
Yeah, and I definitely think that their curiosity leads them to actually become characters in the Dark Sun world, you know, that players become, you know, and obviously they can come from these littler forest villages that are near the city states and you know, have packs with them, you know, of course, but... It seems like Evangian had to leave, but he left us a few points here. Yeah, there's a lot of reasons here that a halfling of the Forest Ridge would leave their homeland. But you don't necessarily have to come from the Forest Ridge, too.
Right, but in the OSB, there's a lot less mention of halflings living outside of the Forest Ridge.
You get to the Ivory Triangle block set, but yep.
Is there no mention of the halflings from the Crescent Ridge in the OSB?
I was trying to look that up. I did not see it.
I think it would be under forced. If the forests are mentioned in the OSB in that one section, it would be mentioned there as the Crescent Forest. Otherwise, it's probably just not in the OSB.
Unless they mention it underneath Gulg, but...
Well, that's a possibility, too.
I tried to look through that real quick just to check, but
Oga has a bigger entry. Well, we definitely know the Crescent Forest halflings are there. Now Nimne uses them, but does Gulg use them?
Well, actually, Nimne doesn't use halflings. It's Gulg. Gulg tried to. And I believe, again, I'm going off the top of my head here, that Lilipe or the Oba basically tried to either force the halfling tribe or made some type of deal with that another halfling tribe that kind of fell through. And they ended up not basically wanting to serve her for whatever reason. But now they're kind of stuck and trapped in the Crescent Forest because, well, it's a long way from Gulg to try to get back to the Forest Ridge. So I think they've either stopped trying and just kind of try to make do and make the best out of a bad situation and have just decided to, you know, settle down in the Crescent Forest.
So they're not originally from the Crescent Forest, those halflings.
Nope, like I said, I think she got kind of jealous of the deal that Hamanu had and try to strike something similar with a different tribe, but it just ultimately fell apart.
A sorcerer king being jealous of another sorcerer king, that would never happen.
Exactly. That's unfounded. But I think that information's found in the Ivory Triangle supplement.
Yeah, because you see, I'm not sure if it's in revised or not. But with the Crescent Forest, so Nimne has an alliance with halflings. Are those halflings originally from the Crescent Forest?
Yes. I believe Ogo, as Dragoth, I think, was saying.
Oh. Oh yeah. Yeah, so they definitely, halflings are kind of get caught in between the war that goes on between Golg and Nimue then.
But like I said, I don't think they serve Lilith any longer.
No, I'd imagine not at this point, huh?
In fact, I'm going to try to look that up as well.
Yeah, and I, from what it seems to me, that the halflings of the Forest Ridge had really good poisons. And there was a lot of creatures in the Forest Ridge that had poisons. Do you imagine the halflings from the Crescent Forest have similar poisons?
I would imagine so. Like I said, I mean, I think they're pretty much the same type of society as the one of the Crescent Forest as it is in the Forest Ridge.
And they probably came from there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they might have slightly different poisons based on, I'm assuming the poisons they're making are based, you know, made from whatever they can find in the forest or the jungle. So the question becomes is how much different is the Crescent Forest versus the Forest Ridge?
Well, we know they have the, was it the Afagari trees?
Yep. Because I think that's pretty much the reason that Golg and Nimue are at war is who has rights to, you know, basically harvest those.
Well, Golg seems more on the thought of preserving and keeping the forest, while Nimue seems to be more on the side of, you know,
deforestation. Yeah.
Well, yeah, Nimue is actively engaged in lumbering, in the lumber industry, where Golg is not. But the Golgans do harvest the Agafari trees. But the trees can be, like, you can take part of the tree and it'll grow back. So they've learned how to live in harmony with them.
Yeah, so they do more like, you know, cut down trees that are dying or dead, and utilize trees that have fallen and branches on the ground that have fallen and stuff like that. Is that what you imagine, Skeletor?
No, they can like literally harvest part of the living tree, but they do it in such a way that it grows back.
Oh, yeah, very cool.
I can imagine to equate it to the real world is, what's it? Not horticulturist. Is it horticulturist that you call? You know, you see your trees dying, and they can come in and tell you, like, cut off the dead limb that's rotting off before it, you know, basically kills yeah. rest of the tree. Yes. So I something similar to that. Yeah.
Yeah, or arborist. An arborist is more of a tree specialist, specifically.
That's the term I was looking for. Thank you.
Yeah, I think we've got a lot of stuff on the feral halflings. I don't think we have many forests of them. I think we've identified three here. I'm not sure if there's any others.
There's not really a whole lot of forests in or on Athys.
Yep.
So the biggest ones would be the Forest Ridge and the Crescent Forest. And then I'm not sure. I like to think that some live in the forest north of Kern.
Very cool.
I could see that, yeah.
You know, there's just always that chance that any mountain area would have at one point contained a halfling city. And then they could have moved down from there as things became less livable.
Definitely. And now they seem to rule from the top of Ziggurat's these chieftains seem quite powerful to me. It mentions that usually a chieftain is a preserver, never a defiler, but their greatest weapon is their psionics. So they don't have the powers of the sorcerer kings, but they do mention they kind of rule these village cities in the same way that SKs rule theirs, that they're the main power. And they do seem to be, you know, dual-class preserver psionicists from what it appears to me to be as in the OSB.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. They bring people up to them, you know, they rule from palaces on top of ziggurats or whatever, and you know, they just have this pull where people worship them. And not for, you know, just the power, but they do kind of hold that same position of the Sorcerer Kings, but seems to have a more direct approach to working with the society, whereas a lot of the Sorcerer Kings are kind of drawn back and, you know, doing their own thing.
Yeah, I definitely think the culture of how they rule over their people is very different. It mentions several times that clan chiefs work together. Even once it mentions that they will do everything to avoid conflict with each other, and they're not much for like trespassing on others' territories. So I think by that nature alone, it's going to be a lot different than being ruled by a sorcerer king. But they're just the powerhouses of their villages or cities in the forest.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The greatest psionicists, very powerful. And they just, you know, they send out their tribes and they raid things and take things. And it's all just to supply the chief with good, rewards from your hunts.
Yeah. Well, and then, so before Evangian left, he mentioned a group of halflings in the Roarhard End Forest. In Brax's material on the area, Aranus of Kern actually kicked them out of the Arona Valley, where Nurkorn is now, in order to set up his paradise. Oh, Mr. Naughty Aranus.
Yeah, that doesn't sound very Evangian, but all right. He must have been still channeling some Celtis there, but all right.
Well, no, there's still... He might have moved them to the forest that's on the other side, because he lives in a pocket of those mountains. But then if you go around the mountains to the other side, there's a large forest area. And I like to think that that is...
Yeah, he was just relocating them, you know, like the Trail of Tears.
Yeah. I'm glad you're here to say it.
Well,
I think that's exactly
what happened. Yeah, there's a tangent in the last D. They did that to the giants up there, but that's a conversation for another time. So...
Yeah, I definitely don't think it was a willingly participation of the halflings. You know, they was relocated, being indigenous to that area. So, Daddy Aranus, he has some answering to do, buddy. One of these days. Yeah, but he says right here another group of them is in the Roarhorend Forest. So I guess that's the forest you're thinking of there, Dregoff.
Yeah, it's got to be. I don't have the map up for the...
For Kern, no. But then, you know, you would imagine that Aranus might actually be able to work with them. But...
I'm sure he does, because he, you know, he works with the Aarakocra that live on the western part of that mountain. And...
Wait. Did he set up New Kern when he was still a defiler, or was that after he became a preserver?
That was after he became a preserver to hide himself and from the other Sorcerer Kings.
Yeah. Exactly.
So basically, it's just a hidden village that he needed so that if anyone came and visited, they would go to Old Kern, and that would be it. You know, like, oh, this is what's becoming of Kern. You know, we don't know what happened to Kaltis. Right, that was his original name before he...
Yep, Kaltis, was it Man Executioner? Yep, that was it.
Yep. So, yeah, he lives on as Kaltis in Kern, but had to create new Kern when he chose to become and work towards the Advangeon transformation so that it didn't draw anyone attention and he wouldn't end up in the same boat as Dregoth.
Sure, yeah. I think Evangeline brings up a good point here about the rule of Thawn and them being very good climbers by necessity. He also brings up that you would think the Forest Ridge is supposed to be a very vertical environment when you're crossing it, you know, kind of as it was described in Book 1, that it would make a lot of sense for the Forest Ridge halflings to be very good climbers as well, or at least the ones who are used to going to raid, you know.
You know.
Well, yeah, climbing through trees especially, because, I mean, the Forest Ridge seems like a very dense and choked off with trees, so.
Yeah, maybe not the whole people would be good climbers, but any of those that are used to raiding for the villages, they would, you know, to go back and forth, they would have to probably be very good climbers. But, you know, you even seen Rykus as good as he was. He had problems climbing it because, you know, they're not climbers who are very proficient in climbing when they're going up those mountains in Book 1.
No.
But the raiding tribes or the raiding parties being very good halflings would make better sense, you know, because how else would they scale the mountains and go over and then come back with their prisoners, you know?
Well, I would think if they have to drag that much stuff back, there has to be paths that they know that lead up into the Forest Ridge that make it easier to move along without having to climb.
Well, interesting note, in the Forest Ridge entry, it mentions there's humanoids, tribes of humanoids or something like that, in the tunnels of those mountains. Doesn't say what kind, though. And that's in the OSB. So if there are tunnels in there, then maybe the halflings have packs with these creatures to allow them quick passage, but they would attack you or me if we tried to use those tunnels. That's one idea there for how they get back and forth.
Yeah, I wonder if they're referring to, what's the name of that? Earth borrowing creatures that they have in the Terrors of Athas. I always want to say Hydrakin, but that's, I don't know Hedgekin. If that's how you pronounce that. Yeah, Hedgekin. I wonder if that seems to kind of fill that. They kind of hide out in tunnels and in caves, I believe.
And there could be a big quantity of them there. But yeah. Interesting to note, the Hedgekin are preservers only as well, so they would get along with the halflings who are also along that mindset. In my opinion, of course.
Yeah, I agree. Nope. Makes total sense.
So the Rule of Thawn, how do you guys like the Jagged Cliff halflings? What do you think about those?
They're very interesting. I like the way that they still remember some of their old abilities, even though it's not quite what it used to be.
Yeah, greatly reduced.
Yeah, the life-shaping tech that they have, they don't even understand how to create it or you know, necessarily make new stuff. They just have the rites and rituals that they adhere to operate the machines, if I'm correct.
No, that's correct. It's like they don't really even understand what they're doing. It's just out of repetition, and as you said, it's ritual. So they've kind of lost their ability to create new life shape. So they just keep producing the same stuff.
It's like after an apocalypse and you have all the ancient tech still laying around and, you know, people figure out how to use it, but they don't really understand how it was made or where it comes from. Or so that's an interesting part that they added in using.
Yeah, none of the context or underlying philosophy.
And it's just another stage of, you know, apocalypse. Grimdark setting that would be there, and they happen to be the relationship to the old ways.
Yeah, so they're about halfway in between, you know, whereas the feral halflings are all the way, you know, a broken culture from what they was into this new culture that they've developed into. The Rule of Fallen is a little more halfway in between, from what they was to what, you know, most of them have become.
Yeah, because they stayed in their, you know, the original area where they came from, where all these devices were at the time.
Right. Whereas most feral halflings descend from those who came down from the mountains and started wandering the lands.
Right.
And the Rule of Thorn have no idea about the rebirth, or I don't even think anything about the Brown Tide.
Yeah, no, they just, you know, I think they have the idea that, you know, it used to be a completely different world and things like that, but, you know, a lot of, you know, the details are probably, you know, myths and legends by now that are after being passed down through history for so long.
Well, I think they stay put because of their ancient leader there, the High Lord. What's it? I always pronounce his name wrong. Ruthon Ez or something along those lines. I don't have the book right in front of me.
You're talking about the one that they're waiting for to return.
Exactly. Like he told them that he went off and he was going to go off to find out what happened to rest of the Rulisti, and then never returned.
Yeah, it would be interesting to know where he went and what became of him.
He basically took on a godlike figure for them, and who knows?
I mean, there's a couple things that either happened to him. I mean, he either died, maybe a sorcerer king captured him, could maybe even tie it into the messenger, which, all right, not ready to go on that.
wait, hold on real quick. I just found in the Life Shaper book, they name the stone. So it says, the first are those grown from an organic porous material called Nin. This ancient matter has a consistency much like a deep sponge. Sea sponge, and in fact, the Rusti discovered this organic stone eons ago at the bottom of the sea.
All right, so I must have confused the video game Pith because I've been searching that same thing. I'm like, where did I come up with this? But thank you.
Yeah, it's referred to as Nin.
Okay.
And then they also created a less common structural material called Ron Roth, and it's a more recent development, but it's still ancient, and it was a medium that was first created by Rusti at the end of the Blue Age. So maybe like an alloy, you could maybe, or something like that, of the life shapes.
Maybe what the pristine tower is made out of.
Well, in my opinion, I think it's that the Rule of Thorn had the idea to stop using the Nen, because they knew about the Brown Tide and, like, you know, how that was caused from using it. And so maybe they just cut, you know, stopped what they were doing. That's why that fell out of use, why there's only the ancient machine still left. And then the Rulisti, when they moved down, they found a replacement now that, you know, all the water was disappearing from the world. There weren't any places to find then anymore. And that might have been a replacement alloy that they used as, you know, to create their buildings and things after that period. So as where the Rulthon might have quit and just said that, you know, this is a bad idea. We'll just, we're going to end it here and not go on. And then the Rulisti were of the same thought. And that's why they might have moved away and started using a new material.
I like that theory. That sounds pretty sound.
It just mentions that they were both used or are used in the village. Or the Jagged Cliffs, I should say.
Yeah, but the way that it worked, as the water decreased, you know, some halflings stayed up top, and then they started to move down the mountain as the water receded and setting up homes. So I don't know if, you know, they were built at the same time, you know, or what happened with that. You know, when did they actually become, you know, go from the Rulthon to the Rulisti, which eventually became the Feral Halflings?
So your question is when did the Rulthon separate from the Rulisti?
Or, like, when did the big change, you know? Obviously, the Rulthon Rulisti was like, the Rulthon tried to stick with their ways, and they stayed, you know, at the top of the Jagged Cliffs, the Jagged Cliffs where, you know, their old homes were. But then as the water receded, the Rulisti spread out. So I don't know when their whole way of life would have shifted from, you know, life shaping and building things like they had to being as the halflings that now live in the other areas away from it, like the Forest Ridge, the Crescent Forest.
There is a part here in the Wicked, the Wind Riders, the Jagged Cliff, that explains that change. And from my reading of it, it seems like it happened over time. I think it's like Silsane was saying, they sent out somebody to go find out what happened. He never came back. So they haven't left yet. And the changes that happened to the other halflings, I don't think we really know a whole lot about that. But the changes of the Rulthon is detailed a lot in the Jagged Cliffs.
I mean, we talked about this offline a couple of days ago, but I just find it interesting that it's like not all the Rulisti were on board about, hey, it's, you know, our time's done. The Blue Age is over. It's now the, you know, the Green Age. The waters have receded. We need to change ourselves into different races. Like, they all clearly weren't on board with that. Hence why you've still got, you know, you got the Rulthon, who seem like they have no clue what was going on. And then you've got the, you know, obviously the feral halflings living in the forest. So for whatever reason, they weren't on board about changing themselves to a different race as well. So.
Well, and I think it mentions why that is because these Jagged Cliffs were so far away from the Tyr region. And, you know, before it was just a ship's ride. Like, if you wanted to get from the Jagged Cliffs to the Tyr region, you just get on your boat and you travel to the islands of Tyr, the Forest Ridge Mountains, right? The Ringing Mountains. But with all this dirt and earth around now, this is suddenly a huge challenge. Just imagine you're the halflings of the Jagged Cliffs, right? Suddenly all this dirt and earth appears, more land than you've ever seen. How do you now cross this great vast distance on land you've never crossed before, so you don't really know the directions? You're used to navigating this on seafaring creatures or ships or whatever they had.
Yeah, on wide open water for the most part. No, that's a good point.
So the Jagged Cliffs, you could imagine, would become isolated because now their main form of travel is non-existent. It's almost like the reverse of Waterworld. In Waterworld, the movie Waterworld, the humans went from a huge planet of Earth to just, you know, no land until they discover one mountaintop. You know, pretty much Mount Everest or something, right? For the halflings, it's the opposite. So they go from a world of water to a world of land, or at least halfway in between at this point. Because we got to remember, in the Green Age, there was still a good amount of water there, but it was more akin to what was on Earth, or is on Earth at this moment. So now they have these vast distances of land to cross. And these lands, you know, they're popping up trees real quick. You know, they're becoming forests from the swampy kind of environment that's now here. And even if it's not swamp, these jagged cliff halflings have no idea how to reach the lands of Tyr on foot. They have no wagons. They have no land-based travel. So I think that is really one of the main reasons the jagged cliff halflings are so isolated and never reconnected with their brothers in Tyr.
Well,
that's a very excellent point.
Yeah, there's a little bit more you can go into on that. Like, because as the waters receded, you know, as it states, the jagged cliffs were like our Mount Everest. You know, they were the highest mountains. They were the points that stuck out, you know, and they could build off of and use that, you know, to live on. Whereas, you know, all the other mountains that we see around the Tyr area, they probably, you know, barely breached the water, if they did at all.
Yeah.
And they started popping up. So it was like there was just a big civilization that kind of lived in that area. And then, you know, as things started to go down and things changed, you know, some, such as the Rule Thon, would have stayed in that area, you know, stuck to their ideals and, you know, just stayed there, maybe spreading out to some of the lower cliffs. But then the Rulisti were more of the ones who were like spread out, you know, separating their ways, and they would have, they went and moved out. And I'm sure that the reason that they decided to change themselves was to meet the requirements of where they were walking, you know, using life shaping. You know, until it came to the point where they just did not, they didn't remember how to change themselves to fit, and they just were stuck as a race, you know, that we would consider, you know, elf, dwarf, or whatever at the time.
Yeah, and I think it's a very interesting point, because you have the big difference between the Tyr region halflings and the Rule Thon of the Jagged Cliffs is knowledge. The knowledge of the Tyr halflings, they know what's causing the brown tide. They know what's up going on here. They have the Pristine Tower. They're in the know. They're in the know of why the world's changing, why the sun's changing, why the brown tide exists. They have something to do with it. So when they start mutating themselves into elves and dwarves, it's because of this knowledge, and they start spreading out. It's because they know there's a big change coming, versus the Rule of Thon, which are so far away and not really tied up in the politics of Tyr, Tigari, whatever you want to call it. The Rule of Thon people don't really know what's going on. They don't have that knowledge. They don't have a knowledge that, you know, why the sun changed, why the brown tide existed. You know, they aren't so much in the know of all that. So,
yeah.
So their reaction's different because of that, I believe, or at least partially.
No, I mean, that's a good point, because maybe, like I said, we're trying to just idealize, like, hey, the Rulisti were just one unified people during the Blue Age, but maybe there was different, like I said, societies, even though they're the one people and they all did life shaping, they all weren't necessarily all interconnected as like one government, one people. They all had their own different things going on. So,
well, you see, that's where I kind of, it separates in my head of how it worked, because in my head, they were all right there. They, you know, there was no this type of halfling. There was no this type of halfling. They all lived at the jagged cliffs because they were the only place that was tall enough for there to actually be land.
Yeah.
As things came down and the water receded, they started spreading out, you know, on their boats and everything, finding, you know, the lower mountains that were being found, and they were building off of those. So all halflings at one time knew about the brown tide, why it was happening, and things like that.
Well, now hold on. In the Jagged Cliffs books, it says there are several locations. There's only a few locations where halflings originate and had cities, or it mentions the Tiger region, and it mentions the Jagged Cliffs as being two independent areas in the Blue Age, having their own areas. So that was pre-Brown Age. So let's just imagine, we don't know the timeline of the Brown Age, but let's just imagine that the halflings of the Tiger region are creating something. This brown tide that it eventually became might have been a secret project for all we know. It could have been a top secret project or something like that. Regardless, there's a decent distance between the Jagged Cliffs and the Tiger region. So if the people that's mainly involved in the Tiger region are creating this brown tide to solve some world problem, there is a chance the people in the Jagged Cliffs would know it was going to happen. There's also a chance that it could have been a very secret project just for that city. But the fact remains, what they were originally going to do with the brown tide and what it became were two different things. So the halflings at the Jagged Cliffs might not realize that the brown tide is what became of that project. They might know that some project was happening and being worked on, but they might not realize that the brown tide is the end result of said project. But I do believe in the... Oh, go ahead.
No, go on. I was going to say, I agree with that thought. I mean, the real world correlation to that, I can't believe I'm going with that, with this. It's like, kind of like, you know, well, the fake origins of, like, COVID. Like, oh, it was developed in this lab.
No politics here, buddy.
Well, okay, well, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, we'll have to cut that out. We'll have to cut that out of the chat.
Sorry. All right,
but
my bad.
Well, and if you want to go to a lesser reference, you know, just developing the Manhattan Project, you know, that was top secret. Of course, that was
fair.
A weapon.
All right, yep.
So that's not really applicable to this situation. I think it's like Dragoff says, if it's a huge... you know, solve the world's crisis, like we're having this problem with feeding our people. We need to do something about it. I do believe there is some reference to the Jagged Cliffs halflings might know about that. But when they finally implicate that situation, I'm not sure if they could recognize the brown tide as being from that thing.
Actually, a better analogy would be like I Am Legend, Will Smith movie. They thought they were developing a cure for, I believe, cancer, and it ended up basically, obviously, not being that, and created, you know, vampire-like creatures, and then the whole world kind of just went to crap. So I think that would be kind of a correlation.
Well, you know... Overall, it all started from the problem of they were, you know, they found something, they thought they knew what they were doing, it turned out that it wasn't good, and it caused some kind of growth or something on the water that was killing off life.
And not every realistic settlement knew necessarily what was going on.
Well, and I'm not sure... Because right here, when the birth of the Rule of Thawne, I think it covers it. Yeah, see, so it says, at the end of the Blue Age, the seas began to die. The life-leaching brown plant caused the waters to recede. So the inverted creation and release of the life-leaching brown plant caused the waters to recede. So... thus, the Jagged Cliffs were born. The brown sludge that caused the sea volumes to decline. So the island halflings descended the now exposed cliffs and discovered that the retreating waters had uncovered a number of large ledges on which whole communities could be reestablished. While the Rusti of the Tigeri area were busy engineering the rebirth, those on the cliffs were isolated on the rocky ledges. It doesn't really mention that they didn't know it was happening. But they definitely, it doesn't seem like they knew about the rebirth. Because, you know, all their ships would have been stranded up higher up on the mountains. Or be on. So, even with the retreating waters, though, they might still be able to take to the waters.
I mean, the rebirth seems like it was kind of like a knee-jerk reaction, but like with all their knowledge and whatnot, I mean, we've talked about this before, but, you know, regarding like how they leap from going, let's change ourselves to different races, well, as opposed to let's remain being realistic halflings.
Well, I think that's a lot of doing with them trying to change themselves to make things easier.
Yeah. You know, adapt to their environment. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I remember we was. Oh, go ahead, Dragoff.
I was just gonna say that led to a lot of, you know, adjusting of features. You know, like, oh, I like to have these pointed ears. You know, and you know, I'm taller. I've got lankier arms, and you know. Just things that worked better for each person, and then that's how things came about, and why, you know, not everything looks the same. There's a lot of twists in each, you know, individual race of how, like, they're not all identical.
Well, which is funny because that rings as life bending, not.
Well, and I'm just going to add real quick that you have. Yeah. You have them turning into dwarves, and the dwarves were very much reminiscent of Tolkien-esque dwarves in the descriptions of them in the Green Age. You know, when Rikus comes upon the, you know, the scenes of, you know, Kemalok and the Citadel of Boris. In these areas, they see pictures of dwarves with beards and the normal dwarven attire. So we do know some of these races they turn into were exact copies of the normal D&D world races. Now, this is a problem for Dark Sun to a certain degree, because you have a lot of people who will go very quickly and mention, you know, heck, there's halflings mentioned in this part of Planescape, you know, or here with Orcus. But if you buy into the lore that there are halflings in other parts of the D&D world, if you look at Dark Sun as a part of the other D&D world that also has halflings, Thrycreen and humans and elves, then you have to understand the ridiculous astronomical chances that these halflings would turn themselves into elves, dwarves, humans, and gnomes without previously having the knowledge of all these creatures.
No, that's where I'm kind of arguing against that it was more of a need to do things. Like, they turn themselves to sturdier dwarves because they wanted to start moving into caves in the mountain, and you know,
but that's my point,
these smaller features to do these things, like they wanted to like fit in, and it created these races in a way that didn't exactly fit. Like,
but that's my point. How would they get so close? And with dwarves 100% close, we have proof they got that exactly right. How would they turn themselves into all these races? What's the chances that they would be able to do that without prior knowledge of these races?
I mean, because coincidence, I mean, so to speak. I know that's lame, but
no. If you're talking to a math guy here, the chances of that happening, elves, humans, dwarves, gnomes, Welmics, pixies, the chances of that happening without them having pre-knowledge of the DNA or the people, to me, as a math person, that is an astronomically high number. That's a higher number than there are stars and planets in the entire universe, probably.
I mean, I hear you. I mean, like I said, I mean, it's like the creation mythos of your standard worlds, where it's like it's a god that created their race. And in every, you know, different crystal sphere reality. You know, they all have elves. They all have dwarves. Typically a different dwarf or a different elven god, you know, Dragonlance.
But there's a big difference. There's a big difference there, because that part's handled in the Planescape campaign setting books. The why that happens, why gods have different creation mythos, is described in the Planescape campaign setting, as why those happen like that. A lot of times it's just a god bragging that he created the universe. A lot of times it's you know, the same dwarven god worshipped on a different worlds by different names. But with the halflings, you can't apply that to halflings, because you have all these ruins of these ancient Rulistes. You've got all their technology, like the Pristine Tower here. So unlike the gods, where you don't see these ruins a lot of times of these ancient gods and their stuff, it's just kind of a mythos. It's what the gods are saying they did to create your world. And whether that's true or not, you can't really prove that, even in the lore a lot of times, because you don't see the actual physical remnants of those gods and their temples and these things that they did on said worlds. Now, sometimes you do. You know, with Greyhawk, you have the Demiurge. With Forgotten Realms, you have the World Serpents or the Yunti or the other 50 things that created the world there. So you do see physical evidence, but you don't see as much of it as you see with the halflings. The halflings, it's 100% here. And it's only recently back. It's only about 16,000 years back. Whereas in the other cases, sometimes it's a long, 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 long time ago. So with the halflings, I think it's a bigger point to make in regards to the canon of how they created these other races here than with the gods. Because like I said, with the gods, you have an explanation in the Planescape book, but you don't really have an explanation of how to correlate these races being created here, you know, without the halflings having some sort of prior knowledge. Now, if they're dealing cloning machines to Orcus, though, that's a pretty big, easy solve right there. You know, they traveled the planes, you know.
Well, I believe that cloning device from Orcus came to Athos and stole that.
Didn't you have a group of Rusti that made its way to a bar in Planescape, or was that just regular feral halflings?
Me personally, no, I didn't have that, but I don't know if that's in a Planescape book or substantiated somewhere, but
it is somewhere. It's been talked about. Like, I've heard it before. I just don't know too much about it.
If I was to guess, it's probably in the Sigil book, in the 2E Sigil book.
Hey, welcome in, June Solar. I seen that picture you posted down there.
The Chamber of Life, I saw that too.
Yeah. I got a couple things, but that's in Baldur's Gate 2, the video game. That's where the halflings are.
Wow. I completely missed that in Baldur's Gate 2. Of course, it was about 10 years
ago. Yeah, they're in the planar sphere.
Yep, correct. And
deep cut.
So that's it. Yeah,
that's it.
Go ahead.
That's what I'm going to say. That's where they're from.
Where was the what was the explanation in the Baldur's Gate 2 for all this?
An archmage was collecting creatures from worlds in the planar sphere. That's it.
So then the Rulisti got a hold of it?
No, they're just a group that you run into in a containment, basically, and you get them free and then they attack you.
Correct.
And this picture right here was from that Baldur's Gate 2 part?
No. This is I've been working on a premise that the Rulisti are basically just space flying halflings from the Messenger. And this is from Superman, the Rulisti.
Oh wow.
That snapshot, it's from Superman's I don't know. I forgot what they called it, but it's like a life chamber. In other words, it has a whole bunch of embryos in stasis. And so
I got it. Yep. All right. Yep.
Yeah. So my thoughts on this is that they didn't create, nobody came from the halflings, but the halflings had a bio ship that has something like a chamber of life where they've collected between them and the Zikchil, they've collected a bunch of embryos of creatures and you know, can birth them, and which is what they do to populate an unpopulated planet. But you can go that way, or you can go. The problem with just saying the Relisti created everybody from them through the Pristine Tower is that in the very first book of the Prism Pentad, it says that there were gods. So, what is it, right? They created them, and there were no gods, or there were gods, and the gods created them, or they brought them from other planes. So you can go either way. I think the ambiguity of things is probably where it's best kept at.
Well said. Very well said. And I think, so you think the messenger still maybe contains stuff in there that can create new life?
Yeah, I've been writing stuff, and I have a whole outline for a future project with the messenger. But yeah, definitely. That's what I would think. It's just off course. You see it, every 7 years or so. So it's almost like if you ever played Gamma World, I don't know if anyone's familiar with that.
Yeah.
I think like the third edition of Gamma World had the Space Wardens, where there was a ship out there that was just waiting for the last space shuttle to show up so they can take off. So basically it was like a world ship. And that's basically what it is. It's basically a world ship, and it brought all its creatures down, and now it's stuck up there waiting for the right pilots, which is Rasthan 1L, which is the Relisti hero god. Yeah, yep. That they're waiting for him, but he's actually made it over there. That's why you haven't seen the messenger in a few years. But now the bio ship took, whatever mental, creature took over, almost like an AI, right? Took over Thass 1L and has him wrapped in some kind of, Relisti bio, whatever you want, right? And one of them was able to break off from the three that they actually need. And that's the piece that crashed on the western side of Athos that creates a great earthquake. That's all me, fanon. That's not anything official.
Yeah.
Very cool, though.
We don't get a lot on the messenger. In the revised, do we? We don't get a lot on the messenger.
No, they have that excerpt because they started in the revised talking about like the resurgence of life shaping and outside of even the Rule Thorn. I think one of the adventures is coming across some type of ancient Relisti ruins that had some life shaping in it, and there's also there's a tablet or something that has a cryptic message on it, which I think they screwed up in the translation of it, like printing it, because it talks about the wanderer returning, but I think they really meant to quote the messenger returning.
Yeah.
Because otherwise that passage makes entirely no sense.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Let's see if I can bring that up.
Yeah, that's in I want to say that's in the revised adventure in the back, or it's in the Relisti book. I forgot what that one's called. I'm looking it up as well.
The wind Riders of the Jagged Cliffs.
Yeah, I think so.
did find it though.
There wasn't much mentioned about the messenger and Revok.
Actually, I got it. So, all right, hold on. I'm going to post it to the group.
One pass.
The chat right there. All right, hold on.
Yeah, because I figured the messenger, it said the messenger like came every 45 years to talk to the dragon, but that just didn't make much sense to me when I was reading it. It had too much of that Spelljammer feel right off the bat.
Yeah, you kind of want to... Again, you want to leave that in the hands of the GM, right? So what you would do is, in order to eliminate, yep, that's it right there. In order to eliminate the whole Spelljammer crossover effect, you can keep it separate by just saying, hey, the messenger comes back, right? And then what crashed, you could say is some kind of Rulisti life-shaping creature, right? And basically... has created, you know, a nation-sized living thing, right? Like in the ground, almost like like the Overmind in
StarCraft.
In StarCraft, or like World of Warcraft, there's a place, I forget what it's called, where it's like underground, like, you know, some kind of life-shaping creatures, like embedded in the earth, and, you know, like it's deep embedded in there, and then outside of it, if it touches creatures, it kind of affects them and turns them into monstrosity or something like that.
Yeah, because you have a example of a ship crashing and creating a city in Dave Arneson's work of Blackmoor. That's more mechanical, you know.
Yeah, Pathfinder also has something similar. They also had a crashed spaceship, you know, that basically was affecting the fantasy area.
Oh, the expedition is very deep, the classic module. So.
Yeah, that's one. Yeah. So there's various ways you can kind of work this. If you don't want to deal with the cognitive dissonance of, hey, were there gods? Were there released these? The creators of everybody, you know, if you want your own mashup, you can literally have it all if you wanted.
I mean, me and Thor were talking about a couple of days ago. One of my big theories is about the Rulisti being a slave race to the Illithid Empire, you know, way, way back before the First World Age. And Thor brought up that, you know, well, maybe they had a repository of, you know, the DNA or whatever you want to call it of other races from other worlds. And that's where when the Rulisti broke away from the Illithid Empire, they actually had, you know, traces of these other races from other worlds.
Yeah, I agree. And that's why I posted that picture, that picture is like a year old or so, but that's exactly what, you know, my frame of thinking is as well. Maybe the messenger isn't even a halfling ships, because halflings aren't known for, you know, space travel for the most part, even through a Spelljammer, but they could have taken one of these ancient Illithid ships from the old Illithid Empire, and that's what's floating up there, and they can't really control it. You know, they need the three guys who did it, and those are the three ancient halflings that are missing that went away with Thass 1L. Basically, he left with two other individuals.
Yeah, we was thinking that maybe the halflings were enslaved and then rebelled and took control of some of the stuff that the Mind Flayers had, like their life shaping tech and other things.
Yeah,
or even the Illithid appropriated you know, the
yeah.
religion, the technology, and
and then the halflings took what they had repurposed, and now they know about that too.
Yeah, and, exactly. Or they did it with the Zikchil, who are the you can make them the precursors to the Thrykreen, right? You can make them all in cahoots. Basically, they all escaped the because remember, the Thrykreen and the halflings were the only two supposedly races that were around, right, in the Blue Age when the place was Waterworld. So they both could be the inheritors of whatever ship they stole. And Zikchil went one way, and the Rulisti went another way.
I think that makes great sense, and that would explain why there's so many Thrykreen on that other side, but there's halflings over here.
Yeah, and of course, you know, the Zikchil, they know life shaping. You know, they know how to do life shaping.
Which is odd. Has they ever explained that in Thrykreen of Athas?
No, when Tim Beach talked about it, he basically was hinting that the Zikchil priests of the Thrykreen are basically like the Zikchil from Spelljammer.
The Zikchil from Spelljammer. I thought Thorkreen was the main Kreen of Spelljammer.
No, Thorkreen is just that got yeah, change into basically what that means is a city dwelling Thrykreen.
Oh, so the Zikchil from Spelljammer are more advanced Thrykreen then, and then that's where these on Athas come from.
Yeah, well, they're not really mentioned as Thrykreen, but I mean, they're insectoids. So if they all came from a insectoid dominant world, you would expect, you know, Zikchil, Zikchil, all kinds of crazy-ass insect creatures.
Yeah, in Spelljammer, they're just described as another mantoid kind of race, and then they were later rolled in under the Thrykreen envelope.
Do they use life-shaping?
Yeah, they were known to do all kinds of body modifications and stuff. They were big into that. If you wanted to have something done to make yourself better at any particular task, you could go to the Zikchil, but you might end up with like some freakish weird thing going on that'll accomplish what you wanted, but it certainly isn't the way that you wanted it.
Yeah, they weren't nice guys.
Well, and then I think that even leads more credence to the mind flare thing, because you certainly don't see Gith or any of them having those kind of life shaping tech, which the Gith and the Forerunners might have just outright rejected that when they rebelled. But you definitely see it amongst the halflings and the Zikchil.
The more you think about it, just kind of like exploring it further, that you could say that Athas is definitely away from, you know, the known worlds. Like it's out there in the astral, right? Or in wild space, whatever, you know, way you want to reference it. But it's probably close to the Thrykreen homeworld and the Illithid, the old Illithid empire, which is why all of this stuff is resonating.
Yeah, because I think in Lords of Madness, it's brought up that mind flayers actually come from the future. And then that whole plot line, it goes on from there. That their empire actually is started by mind flayers who came from the future where they were being defeated by the slave races for the last time. I'm not too sure about all that, though. I do know the mind flayer empire was extremely expansive, so it could have reached all the way to known Spelljammer space, all the way to Athas, you know, with very little trouble.
Yeah, well, in the known worlds, they're not very prevalent, right? They're there, but they're not like, you know, overwhelming.
Their empire's falling apart.
Yeah, and on Athas, obviously they're pretty much unknown unless you take the Eastern Tablelands mantra with the dark cupola. So I mean, it's possible, right? You could have them in there as well. I would. I would just not make them the Thrykreen, you know. I'd make them like having chitinous armor or something to cover for the slime. Otherwise, they'd dry up.
Oh, that's a good point, Silsane. How do they avoid drying up?
They stay underneath the Doc Coppola in Dampville. Oh.
Yeah, it's like a jungle under there, right? It's a humid environment.
Yeah, like they basically stay there for the most part. Otherwise, they use their gift or other thrall races that, you know, other thrall subjects, I should say races, to go out and do their bidding, which is why they're trying to, you know, well, they have plans to not have that happen so they can get outside from out underneath the Dark Coppola.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. You had an adventure where the party was being tracked by three or four of the mind flayers in damp suits, weren't they?
Correct. Basically, it was one mind flayer with intellect of ours, but yes.
All right, fellas. It's time for me to bow out.
All right. Have a good night.
Later, Skelly.
All right. Bye, Skelly.
Yeah, I think the Mind Flayer angle was pretty, you know, it seems like everybody's got kind of an angle on the messenger, you know?
Yeah, the spaceship thing has been around for a while. I want to say at least 20 years. So it's not something like I made up. It's been around in the community for quite some time. I say 20 years is probably, you know, even longer.
No, I mean, yeah, it has been. I mean, and I actually like it. I mean, I like the angle that you have with it. Like, I always took it like it wasn't necessarily a spaceship, but it was something that was like an escape pod that was hurled from Athens with the three, like, either, you know, three halflings or Relisti that were kind of like, all right, we're out of here. It's, you know, kind of like a Krypton Superman thing. The world's screwed. Let's get out of here. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily leave underneath its own propulsion, but was kind of just launched and then later on crashes into Athens because of reasons. But,
right.
You know, like I said, I like your take as well.
Yeah, we had a, I think on the Pristine Tower, Adam and I, we had come up with some of those ideas because I had already talked that, I want to say about a year or two ago. And he posted that. I don't know when he posted that, but he did post it so everybody else can take a crack at it or look at it. You know, it's just not a lot of people don't want the whole Spelljammer spaceship, you know, messenger. But even if you don't use it, you could use a piece of the messenger fell off, like you said, a pod. And that's on the other side of the world.
But the main messenger in yours would be still up there.
Yeah, and the reason you haven't seen it again, it's because it's got a recock. So like a real comet, right? If it gets too close to the sun or whatever, it changes its course, its declination and stuff. And so you'll see it again when it comes around the sun, but it might not have been in a position for Athos to see it, depending on where it was on the sky. So we can throw astrophysics into this as well and say, yeah, you wouldn't have seen that comet anymore because there was a course change due to the fact that a large chunk of it fell onto the planet. So many ways you could do it if you wanted to skin it.
How many people are working? I know the Pristine Tower is working on a messenger.
No, they're not working on it.
No,
they're not. We just put that out. We wanted to share it because it came up. And so Adam and I talked about it, and I was just like, yeah, just give it to them. I mean, unfortunately, I'm working on so many other things that I just don't have the time. And if somebody else has the time and could put in some effort, you know, things get done faster in the group sometimes.
Sure. Sure. The messenger is a topic that's got a lot of theories on it. You know, I'm sure there was chats going on it back in the day on the old forums, you know.
And absolutely.
Yeah, there were. Yeah, I remember. Too bad I didn't save all that stuff. I never thought that that all those chats were just going to go away. The zombie.
We were talking about that earlier. Shit, that was an archive. So.
Yeah. I mean, I have a feeling it has been archived, but D&D won't release it. I heard that they have stuff in servers that from back in those days, they just won't open it up for whatever reasons.
It's unfortunate. That's how it goes sometimes. There's a lot of ways. The halflings is a big topic in Dark Sun, being, you know, the creators of a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, I was never a fan of that. In fact, I mean, I was never a fan of the anything after book two from the prison pentad. Or book three was okay too, but after that, I mean, things just got weird. Like, they were going off the deep end, and then when they made all the changes were revised, it was just like, there's no, you know, ambiguity went out the window. So
it's all sealed in stone now.
Yeah, exactly. So now whenever you try to make something different, somebody's going to come back at you like, no, but there was no other humans. The halflings made everybody. You're kind of stuck with it now.
Yeah, I think that's why a lot of people are like, well, we're going by the OSB, you know, so they can.
Yeah, that's me all the way, man. I go by OBS all the way.
I don't mind the revised stuff. I like the unique, like I said, origin mythos of Athas. So it's not just like, yeah, it was a god that made everything and made these races. I mean, I agree it kind of got a little too sci-fi, but I think there was a way to kind of reel it back a little bit. So.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, remember, you could have made a god very much in the vein of the immortals from old D&D. In other words,
yeah, pretty old D&D, yeah.
You know, you can become so powerful that you basically, you know, just earn the divine right? You become like semi-divine like the immortals do. Just by, you know, you just reach just, you know, epic levels, kind of like the advanced beings now, but before all that, and you could have been that. Like for me, the god of the sun is Taraskir for me. You know what I mean? Like he was the ancient god of the sun. That's it. God of chivalry and the sun. And that Joker, when he lost all his godliness, when Rajat took everybody's godliness away, this is all my fanon, then, you know, Dragoff killed him.
Well, I think that's what the OSB gives people, the option of having their entire story, you know, creating something awesome and that's unique to your campaign setting, you know, for your dark setting. And you see that in the Greyhawk gold box is similar to that. And I think the Dark Sun OSB has more potential than something like the Greyhawk gold box. Because, again, they have it where it's you've always got gods in Greyhawk. But in Dark Sun, you can go with the gods with the OSB or you can go somewhere completely different with it.
Yeah. Yeah, the thing I like about Greyhawk and gods is that they have quasi-gods, they have semi-gods, they have demigods, they have hero gods. Right. And they all have like different levels of strength and, you know, abilities, which is makes it very interesting.
Yeah.
But I do like that. I do like that Athas has no gods.
Yeah, it makes it different. It makes it really simple and really different in those regards, I think. But you know, when it comes to you know the halflings, I think it's a good point to bring up that they are the creation mythos of Dark Sun for a lot of people. But you can always go with the OSB and have your own creation mythos for how Dark Sun came to be this crazy world.
Well, I mean that's kind of like what they did, in, you know, not to bring up edition specific, but like 4E kind of like threw a lot of that out, like kind of like pick your own adventure of what the, you know, the origin of Athas was.
Yeah, I think it went in a completely different way. I really wish they would have throughout, if they're going to do that, I wish they would have thrown out more and then just been like, this is a new take on the you know, the OSB or the original mindset of Dark Sun. But I wish they would have thrown more out and gave us something a lot different. That's something that's really just, you know, it really seemed to be more of a patchwork thing at what that came out in the fourth ed Dark Sun.
I like 4E Dark Sun. I mean, you know, obviously some things go against the grain from what's, you know, published canon, which is exactly why, right? If you took away the ambiguity, now you're going to have, you know, nerds like us arguing about what's more relevant. Is the old canon better than the new canon?
Yeah. And I think if they would have went like, been like, look, Rajat didn't create none of this. Halflings weren't created here. We're going with a whole new creation mythos. And you know, we could go with a whole different one when 5e comes out, you know?
Yeah, but
I mean, they kind of did with like the whole primordial defeating the gods, kind of just the opposite of Greek mythology, like with the gods overthrowing the Titans. So,
yeah, I think that part there, they could have made it a little bit more ambiguous, right? Which, if you really think about it, when you look at Doomspace, the 5e folks took. Because Doomspace is basically Athas, they took that storyline, the primordials versus the gods storyline, and used it. And that, you know, you could just see it basically that the gods finally found a way to break into the crystal sphere of Athas, the only solar system with a crystal sphere, huh? Right? It was hilarious that they did that, but. When you read Spelljammer 5e, you know, that's basically what it's saying. It's saying that the gods finally broke through the crystal sphere that the primordials built when they beat the gods and kicked them out of Doomspace.
Wow. Now, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
Almost a whole other topic for another Dragon Talk. But
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, There's ways to, you know, build your release the how you want them. I mean, you can make them the boogeyman. You can make them these ancient creatures. I mean, you can make them the fathers of and mothers of all the creatures if you want to. Not that it would make a lot of sense because you need a lot of halflings to create viable creatures.
Yeah, you would need quite a few.
Yeah, unless we're using the Adam and Eve, you know, mythos, where basically, hey, two people can build everybody. That doesn't work either.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to go with that. This ain't hey, stepbrother, hey, stepbro kind of thing. But yeah, I think there's a lot of ways you can go with the realisty, you know, and you know, what their current mindset or what their mindset was. Not that it really has a whole lot to effect on your game.
No, because it's so far in the past. I mean, as fun as it is to speculate, a lot of people, you know, and I kind of echo it to a point where it's like, yeah, it's what type of bearings is going to have on your current at this game? Not much. I mean, granted, with the whole, the meta, you know, plot of what they were going before they discontinued the Dark Sun line. Seems like they were gonna be brought back, but
yeah, I think it really matters if you as a DM decide you're not gonna use it, and then like your old ruins and your ancient, you know, dungeons your players explore, that stuff has more of the creation mythos of your Dark Sun in it. That's where you would need to know if you're using realisty or not. Back lore. If you're like, oh, I've got this new way of how the world was created, well, they're not going to find Blue Age ruins because there is no Blue Age in your universe, your setting, you know?
Yeah.
So what ancient ruins will they find? What ancient knowledge will they know, you know, written in ancient books, you know, that kind of stuff. But hell, I think we've covered this topic pretty good. We're about to run into 3 hours on this chat. I think I may go ahead and shut the recording off now. We could just talk, you know, general Dark Sun.
All right. That's fair.
All right. Well, thanks everybody for coming for Dragon King Talk. Stay for the after party.